Okay, I'm calling to order finally this House Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy. Welcome to members, and welcome members of the public who are with us. As I often say, if folks are watching online, our meeting materials are posted on our website, so you want to make sure to check that out. We're going to start, as we usually do, by having the clerk take the roll. Ms. Kahn, if you can please do that.
Chair Pinto?
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Present.
Lee Daniels?
Present.
Representative Bliss?
Present.
Representative Coulter?
Present.
Representative Davis?
Here.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Present.
Representative Hicks?
Present.
Representative Hudson?
Present.
Representative Katizawatoon? Representative Lee?
Present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Perez Vega?
He is excused.
And Representative Celeste Carr?
Present.
We have a quorum. Excellent, members. And so we can use that quorum to do a couple items of business. We're going to have approval of our minutes. And so, members, these are in your packet. Members of the public, these are posted online. We're going to go through the minutes of our first two meetings, the first one being Thursday, January 5th. If I can have a motion to approve those minutes. You just say so moved if you're into
so
that.
Moved.
Did I hear, pardon, who was that? Representative Hudson. Thank you, sir. So Representative Hudson moves approval of our minutes of January 5th. Any additions or corrections to those minutes, members? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we have our first motion passed. That's good. So we've approved our minutes on January 5th. And then our minutes of Tuesday, January 10th, if I can have a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
And that was Representative, didn't see who that was. Pardon me.
So moved.
Representative Hansen, thank you. And so any additions or corrections, members, to the minutes of Tuesday, January 10th? And hearing none, the motion again is to approve the minutes of January 10th. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. And we have our second motion pass, and we have two sets of minutes approved. Excellent. So members, we're going to hear a presentation today about early care and learning from Dr. Aaron Sojourner. And so I'm excited to hear that. And that will set up then our very first bill hearing on HF 150, which is the bill that I'm bringing forward. To confirm, we'll be discussing that bill, receiving some testimony on that bill. We will not be voting or acting on the bill. I anticipate there'll be an amendment that that will be coming, and I'll describe what I anticipate with that. That'll be at a future meeting, but we'll at least be hearing that bill today. So are there questions, members, before we dive into our agenda? And not seeing any, we're going to just dive in then. So Dr. Sojourner, if you can please come on up. And I should note that Dr. Sojourner has presented before the committee that I have chaired in the past couple of sessions and has got deep expertise, and I'm really excited to have him back. So when you are ready, sir, you can introduce yourself. We've got presentations up in the different screens. I think the members should have copies of the handout of the slides as well. So introduce yourself and please begin.
Great. I'm Aaron Sojourner. I'm a labor economist. Spent 13 years at the Carlson School of Management at the U. And I still am an affiliated researcher at the U, but moved to work at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research this past summer, which is a nonpartisan independent research institute. I've done a lot of research on early childhood education. I've done a lot of work on early childhood policy at the White House Council of Economic Advisors at various state and local levels as well. So I'm here to talk to you about what does economics have to say about early childhood care and learning and policy and the implications of the choices you're making in your work. So the big theme I want to communicate to you today is that we ask the most of parents when they have the least. And it matters a lot what happens in kids' early experiences when we ask the most of parents and when they have the least. So, you know, as a labor economist, I'm a labor economist because people, I believe, and a lot of evidence shows, people really drive community prosperity. People really drive community success. You know, without capable, energetic, strong people, in our lives and in our communities, you know, it's not going to flourish. So the second piece is that wise investment in people and in our development is what makes us capable and energetic and healthy and strong and able to contribute to our families and our communities. And, you know, or lack of investment makes those things harder because people develop through a process of, you know, from birth into adulthood. If you want to understand how people are going to do as adults, you can't do that without understanding the experiences they have when they're young. So within that, you know, there's three big points I want to make today. Income-based gaps in skill open up really early in kids' lives, but they're not inevitable. Again, we ask the most of families when families have the least, and that early childhood investment can have really big returns, really big impacts on kids' lives, on family budgets, on the economy, and on labor force, labor supply. So what do I mean when I say income-based gaps open up early? So if you look, this is from a White House Council of Economics Advisors report, but there's a lot of similar graphs you can find. As you can see on the horizontal from left to right, you have kids' ages, age 1, age 2, up to age 5, and then out to 14. And the blue line on the top is kids whose families make, you know, the top 20% of families in terms of income. And in the orange line at the bottom, you have kids of parents who make the 20% least in the country. So the bottom fifth in terms of income. Or sorry, 25%. These are, the top quarter and the bottom quarter. And what you can see is that early in life, if you measure kids' skills, basically their mental development, and it's a different measure at each age, you know, because you can't ask the same test at every age, but the appropriate test at each age, what you see is that early in kids' life, there's not a huge gap. There's a pretty big gap between kids from high-income and low-income families, but it gets wider and wider over the first 5 years of kids' lives. But then something happens around age 5 where it stops growing and where it stabilizes, and the gap is still there, but it's not widening anymore once they get to age 5. You can see this if you do brain scans of kids. If you, again, on the horizontal, you have kids' ages. This time it's in months. So this is just the first 3 years of kids' lives. And you have the green line is kids from high socioeconomic status families, you know, again, well-off families. The blue line is kids from more disadvantaged families. You can see that in the first year of life, the architecture of the brain is very similar. Those lines are all grouped together. But in the next 2 years, you know, from age 1 and 2, you see these gaps open up in the architecture of their brain. And if you look at later outcomes, if you look at adult employment, and you can see that kids who grew up in more disadvantaged circumstances are less likely to be working as adults. So again, on the horizontal here, you have the average income of a kid's family when they were young in the first 5 years of life. And you can see that kids who are very low income, when they're adults, on average, they're working about 1,000 hours a year, which is like half time, versus, you know, if they grew up in a middle-class family or a higher-income family, you know, it's closer to 2,000 hours a year on average, which is closer to full-time. So, you know, you see these gaps in skills open up early. You see these gaps in brain architecture open up early. And you see differences in adult outcomes in the labor market and earnings, and you could look at wages, you can look at any, you can look at criminal justice involvement, you can look at a range of positive and negative outcomes, and you see the same pattern. But a question you might ask yourself is, look, these are different kinds of families, these are different kinds of kids. Maybe they live in different kinds of communities. Maybe there's something like fixed about that difference. Maybe it's we can't do anything about it. That's just, they're different folks, they have different patterns. But there's a lot of evidence that's not true, that better early experiences for kids can break this relationship between family income and child development or adult outcomes. So this is evidence from a study I did about a decade ago where we had, and it's actually a study that was done before that. I was reanalyzing data. They recruited families who are giving birth in hospitals in 8 cities around the country. And they randomly assigned some of them to have access to 2 years of free, full-day, high-quality child care. The experimenters were child developmentalists, doctors. They actually set up high-quality child development centers in each city, and they staffed them, and they ran them for a few years. And, again, they recruited 1,000 families giving birth in hospitals. They randomly assigned some of them to have access to the center, some of them not to. Nothing systematically different about the two groups, except, you know, heads or tails. And what you can see is that access to that child development center started at age 12 months. If you look at the low-income families that were in the sample and you compare the ones who had access to the ones who didn't, at age 1, there wasn't much difference because, again, the access to the center didn't start until age 1. But at age 2 and at age 3, they gave mental development, cognitive skill tests to kids in the treatment group, same tests to kids in the control group. Nothing systematically different about their backgrounds or their families or their communities. Only thing different was, did they have access to this high-quality child development center? Did they have access to home visiting? And what you see is that the kids who were in the treatment group were scoring 1.3 standard deviations higher than the kids in the control group at age 2. And at age 3, after 2 years of access to this center, they were scoring a standard deviation and a half. So that's like 22 IQ points higher. That's a huge number. What it means is that kids in the low-income kids who had access to the center were outperforming higher-income kids who didn't have access to the center. So basically, like, the skills gap that we saw in the observational data was erased. There was no gap between kids from low-income families and kids from high-income families if those low-income kids had access to this high-quality care experience. The experiment ended at age on the kid's 3rd birthday. The centers were shut down. They were sent back into the community to go about their lives. What do you think happened, 2 years later when they went back and measured all the kids on cognitive development? What do you think happened 5 years later, 15 years later, when they went back? So 2 years later, at kindergarten entry, the effect on kids' skills had shrunk. It shrunk from 1.6 standard deviations down to about 0.6. But that is still massive. 0.6 standard deviations is like 10 IQ points. Again, that's like almost closing the gap between low-income kids and higher-income kids. Even 5 years later, it was still half a standard deviation more. And again, that's like about 75% of the gap between low and high-income kids. Even 15 years later, there was still a persistent difference. If you look instead at kids from higher-income families, the effect was much weaker. So there were still big effects during the program, but then in the follow-up, at age 5, 8, and 18, there weren't, you should think of these roughly as zeros, like noisy zeros. There wasn't much effect. So it kind of faded out for higher income kids. That's not always the case. In some experiments and in some policy evaluations, higher income families do show a benefit. It really depends on the specifics of the programs, of the families, of the communities. But I think the takeaway for me from this is that these gaps are not inevitable, that they are very malleable, that if kids from disadvantaged families especially have access, well, look, early experiences matter for every kid. And kids from high-income families, advantaged families, they get access to high-quality environments every day, and other kids don't. And that makes a difference. So now, so please feel free to interrupt me. I'm here for your benefit. Like, if I know I'm moving through a lot of numbers and a lot of things quickly, but if there are clarifying questions anyway.
Dr. Sojourner, thanks for making that point, because, certainly clarifying questions are always welcome, and I'll go to Lee Daniels. Representative Daniels, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious. I'm just curious if any of the data points to single parents versus two parents in the home. And another part two would be how involved with the parents, because I've got children and grandchildren that the spectrum is pretty wide, and it's a lot to do with the parent involvement. So is there any data that includes that?
Dr. Sojourner.
Yeah. So certainly I think, like, what matters for kids' development, I think the best evidence says the most important thing is, like, the quality of the interactions they experience, above and beyond, like, health and safety and nutrition, you know, and just basics of life, is, like, attention, face-to-face interactions, you know, warm, supportive environments. There are differences between single parents and two-parent households. There's a lot of differences. And we can't randomly assign, you know, kids to have married or single parents. Like, it's not a malleable policy lever, like access to high-quality care. But certainly the ability to shape that experience the kid's having does have an impact. And one thing that we actually saw in that study was that, especially among the kids from more disadvantaged families, when the kids were randomly assigned to have access to this high-quality care, the quality of parenting actually went up, the measured quality of parenting. So we interpret this as like an effort effect, that parenting is hard. The first hour of high-quality parenting, you know, takes a lot of energy. You got to be down there and, you know, engage. But you can do it for an hour. You can do it for 5 hours, maybe. 17 hours in a row, you get a little strung out. Day after day, week after week, that is hard. So giving parents the ability to parent a little less can actually make them, allow them to parent better in the time when they're parenting. So there's evidence of that in this study and in other studies.
Sharing the load, Dr. Sojourner, a little bit for folks in tough circumstances.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
I think
there's a couple other questions.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes, that's okay. Representative Daniels, anything further from you, sir? Not at this time?
No, I'm good. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. And I think, was there a... Okay, so then maybe not somebody else. Okay. So then in that case, please do continue, Dr. Sojourner.
Yeah. So there's a Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago named Jim Heckman. He's done a series of studies that looked at tried to measure the rate of return to investments in early childhood. And you can think about this like any kind of investment. There's an upfront cost. You have to pay upfront, but then you get something that delivers a stream of benefits over time. Okay? That's like if you're a business person, you're buying a new piece of technology, you have to pay up front, but it makes you more productive. You get a stream of benefits over time. And so you can calculate the rate of return on investments in early childhood development or programs by looking at how much does it cost up front, and then what are the benefits over time. And the benefits are things like lower special education service costs, less grade retention, less criminal justice involvement, more earning in the labor market, higher wages, more taxes paid, less social benefits used. So if you do the tallying, again, this guy's done this tallying very carefully, and what he found, if you look in the bottom right corner there, you know, a range of estimates under different kinds of assumptions and different subpopulations, and this is adjusted for inflation, he found, you know, rates of return something like 8.3%, 8%, up to 11%, so something in that range. I'm sure you know Art Rolnick, a great Minnesota economist from the Federal Reserve Bank, and Rob Grunewald. They did similar studies, and they got even higher rates of return. These are for programs that were run a long time ago. But you can think about the rate of return. If it's 8%, let's be conservative and say it's 8%, the bottom of this range of estimates that this Nobel laureate Heckman got. You can compare the use of resources in terms of investing it in early childhood programs versus investing it in the stock market. The stock market delivers a rate of return. Companies buy machines, they buy technology, they use their resources to maximize profits and deliver a stream of revenues. And if you look at the average rate of return in real inflation-adjusted terms, since World War II, it's about 6%. So you're getting about 6% for capital invested in the private economy. You're getting about 8% for capital invested in young kids. And I want to tell you, this is a surprising fact, that 8% return is much more than double a 6% return. Why is that? Because of exponential growth. So if you invest a dollar, and then you go out 50 years. If you get a 0% return, you still have a dollar, right? If you get a 6% return, you have about $20 at the end of 50 years. If you get an 8% return, you have $50. So, like, small differences, a 6%, 8% difference, that might not sound like much, but we're talking about long payoff across someone's whole life. In their career, and over that time horizon, you know, that small difference is actually pretty big.
Dr. Sojourner, I know we've got a question from Representative Hicks. I'm going to call on her. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much for being here today. I heard you just quickly mention special education and the role that this plays, and I just want to highlight the importance of families knowing that maybe their child needs some extra support.
Yeah.
And having access to early high-quality childcare and parent training and parent support allows those concerns to be validated, heard, brought to the forefront, and make sure that those kids, if they need some additional supports, whether that be OT or PT or special education services, that they're able to access those and parents understand the pathway to get those services. So many times, families know that their child maybe is struggling with something, but they don't understand how to get those extra supports. And when they have these high-quality professionals in their lives, they can access those resources sooner and get the supports that their kid needs. And every mom, every mom I've ever worked with who has a child with a disability, including myself, has felt so validated when those professionals are able to say, yes, let me help you get connected. And so I know we just kind of glossed over it, but I just want to always bring us back to making sure that we're identifying our little Minnesotans with disabilities and making sure that they're getting what they need as well and their families.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks. Yeah.
Thank you.
Dr. Sojourner, yeah, please continue.
Yeah, so that's my second big point here is that we ask the most of families when they have the least. And what I'm going to tell you is from a combination of sources, but you can find it if you're interested, or I'm happy to connect you with it. So the point is that families have privately the least resources early in their kids' lives. As kids get older and parents get older, we get more private resources. Instead of compensating for that, public policy, like, reinforces that. And it means that we invest very little early in kids' lives and in young families, and we invest a lot more in older kids and later in kids' lives and in other things. So, and families, we put, like, families have the most responsibility early in kids' lives, and then later in kids' lives, we provide much more support that, you know, lightens that load a lot. So let me give more specifics to that. So if you think about a family, a parent, when they're young, when their kids are young, they're young compared to when their kids are older. And that means they've had less time to work and earn and save than, you know, they will have had later. In terms of their current earning power, if you we did a study of this, and what you can see is that if you compute how much workers' parents are earning at different stages in their kids' lives, you know, they're earning much less. The line is showing you the average hourly wage, and the bars are showing you the difference from the average. When your kids are 0 to 2, you're earning about 8% less than you will on average when the parent, when the kids are home with you. When your kids are older, you know, getting close to college age, you're earning 10% more than average. So your earning power when your kids are young is low because you don't have as much experience, you don't have as much education maybe. And it's true that you do have more future income when you're younger, when your kids are younger. You have, like, you can look to the years ahead and say, okay, I'm going to make more in the future than when my kids are older. But when your kids are younger, you actually have lower credit scores. So you have lower access to that future income than you will when you're older. People are more willing to lend you money when your kids are older than when your kids are younger. So if you think about families' finances, like, and you think about when your kids are young versus when your kids are older, when your kids are young, you're really cash strapped. You have less past earnings, you have lower current earning power, and you have less access to future income. Past, present, and future, that's all the kinds of income, right? And you have less of all of them. So there's no sense in which parents of young children have more resources than they will later in life. They're quite strapped, and they're trying to juggle this dual responsibility of care and earning, keeping a roof over their head and making sure their kids are having a good experience. And they don't have a lot of private resources to do that. You'd think, okay, well, maybe the public is going, like, public policy is going to help deal with that. And so, you know, people have done research to try to tally up. If you look across all federal programs, all state programs, all local programs, and you figure out, you know, how much money is flowing to kids at different ages and families with kids at different ages. And you look at early care and education, K-12 education, but also housing, nutrition, health, Medicaid. You look at, and you look for older people. You look at Medicare, Social Security. You look at, all the public social spending across all levels of government. And you tally it up, how much do we spend or invest on people at different phases of life? And what you see is that in the first few years of life, we spend about $8,000 per year per kid. A lot of that is around the birth of the child, the medical expenses. And then, you know, in the first 5 years, it's about $9,000. But once kids hit age 6, once they're in K-12, there's this big bump up in spending, you know, above $15,000 per kid per year. And just for scale and comparison, you know, if you look at older adults, 65 and over, we spend about $32,000 per senior per year. So, yeah, just information for you. And if you focus just on the early care and education side, ignore health and cash assistance and things like that. Just early care and education, what you see is that in the first 3 years of kids' life, this is, again, federal, state, local government. This is from a report I did with Liz Davis, who's a professor at the U. We spend about $500 per kid per year in the first 3 years of kids' lives in America on early care and education. During preschool age, 3 and 4, it goes up to about $2,500 per kid per year. But once kids hit age 5, and then for 13 years in a row after that, we invest something like, I don't know, $13,000 a year. So, like, if you compare early versus K-12, we spend about 9 times per kid per year later in kids' lives than early. And consequently, the care burden falls very heavily on families when their kids are young. So the yellow and orange bars show you, like, publicly financed care. And this is showing, like, child time during the work week. And it's showing you how, on the vertical, it's showing by age. So 0 is the first year of life, 1 is the second year of life, and so on. And it's a time diary. It's built from a nationally representative time diary of kids. So they surveyed, you know, thousands of families across the country and had them record where the child was spending their time. And what you can see is that, like, in the first few years of kids' lives, either through parental care, the green, or through unpaid friend, family, and neighbor care, the gray, or through, like, private pay, you know, care that families purchase in the dark blue, families are providing, like, over 90% of the time, covering the cost of more than 90% of kids' time. Once the kid hits age 6 and up, you know, the family is only bearing the responsibility of about half of the child's time during the work week, and this includes summers and stuff. So, again, you see this big imbalance in resources and investment. You see it show up in sort of differential burdens in the weight of that family responsibility to provide care. It's especially heavy when kids are young. You might say, okay, well, that's not so bad. Maybe it's cheap to provide care when kids are younger. Like, sure, we don't put in a lot of resources, but, you know, it's because it's pretty easy. But it's not. It's harder. It's more expensive because you need more adults per kid. And, like, I taught at the U, at the business school, you know, I had 100 people in my class. I could make a pretty good wage because we were pooling over 100 people to pay my salary, and they were paying a lot of tuition. And, you know, thank you to the legislature for public investment in higher ed, too. But, you know, if you're paying somebody to take care and educate younger children, you can't put one adult in a room with 100 people. With 100 kids, you have to put four infants, like three, like that's a lot of work. That's hard. They really need that. And if you try, if you split that person's attention too finely, then, you know, the kids aren't getting a good experience and they're not developing, and it's going to have implications for their future and for all of our futures. Because, you know, they're not going to develop the skills and capacities and motivations that will make them more productive in the future.
Dr. Sojourner, I might just pause you here just for members that I often hear people saying, my goodness, you know, infant care costs as much as college. And, I mean, this would say it actually should cost more than college, not just because of on the expense side, because, as you say, you can spread out the number of young people much more, college students, than babies. But then also, your earlier slides indicate it's actually a heck of a lot more important than college. If you had to choose 1 year to get a high-quality experience for your kid, you'd rather have when they're 0 to 2 than when they're college-aged. So just to kind of highlight that point, and I guess the other thing is just that I feel like you're kind of talking about the tension between doing things cheaply and doing them well, and that there is a tension there. You know, that 8% return comes from making sure that there's a high-quality experience and there's that payoff. So we kind of have to, and then otherwise, in my work as a prosecutor, you're going to pay me and others later to deal with it in 25 years if we didn't do it right at the beginning.
Yeah, I agree with that point very much, that quality matters a lot. Like, and from public policy perspective, it's relatively easy to and cheaper to subsidize low-quality care, but you pay for it in other ways. You pay for it down the road in other ways, and that's the choice you have. I mean, there's no escaping that logic. So, you know, the situation where we ask the most of families when they have the least creates a set of crises for families and communities that, like, is entirely predictable, and like, what else could we possibly expect to happen, honestly? Like, you hear about it, it shows up, it has different faces, you hear about it in different ways. You hear, there's not enough slots. I can't, like, I have people who want childcare because they need to take a job, or I'm trying to hire people, but I can't find anyone who, you know, the only people I can find have kids and they can't find a childcare center. There's not enough slots because families can't pay the cost, cover the full cost of care because they're credit constrained and they don't have enough private resources at that point in their life. And, you know, so there's, and there's not the public support either. And so there's not enough private resources, there's not enough public resources. So the, it's hard for the child care market to produce enough care at a level that supplies the need. And again, like, families want to invest more, but they don't have access to private funds. The public gets a big benefit from high quality care in terms of all these knock-on effects down the road, but the child care centers can't capture that revenue. You know, they're providing a service that has really big benefits. But those benefits, the parents don't get all those benefits. A lot of those benefits go to neighbors and future employers and taxpayers through averted juvenile justice and adult criminal justice. And so there's a lot of public benefits from high-quality care that the child care providers can't capture. So they can't, like, produce at a level that is efficient. They're underproducing.
Dr. Sturgeon, there's the reference to workforce instability. Am I right that that would be connected to the experience of the child and the quality as well? I guess I'm thinking about Dr. Subramanian talking about the importance of stable relationships for a child. If there's a constant stream of people coming through, that's going to be worse for the experience as well. Can you just comment on that briefly?
Yeah, thanks. So you have these shortages, you have unaffordability, you have the lack of, not enough resources going in, and so consequently the pay is very low, the compensation for this work is very low, so it becomes really hard to retain people, it becomes really hard to develop an experienced workforce, because there's just so much turnover, and the Starbucks is paying more, and the Home Depot is paying more, because they can raise their prices, they capture the full value of what they sell. Child care providers do not capture the full value of what they sell, and they can't from the parent. And so it's really up to the community to say, look, we recognize the benefits that these folks are creating, and let's reflect those benefits through policy. So, yeah, you get more turnover, really high rates of turnover of providers, and as you said, Chair Pinto, the quality of care is quality of relationships, quality of experiences, trust, you know, nurturing. And that's hard to create when you have a new teacher every 2 months. You know, the stability of the workforce is quality, or it's certainly strongly related to the quality of the relationships the kids and adults have. And then you also have crisis in young families' budgets. You know, it's hard for parents to earn enough to pay for care. It's hard for them to forego an income to provide care, and that's kind of the choice that they have. Neither one of them works very well. And, you know, we're just hammering families when their kids are young. That's the upshot. And so you also have, like, homelessness. You have people losing housing instability for families. You have workforce crisis. You have providers telling you that they're going out of business. They can't stay in business. Like, all of these different crises are all rooted in the lack of investment. And we see that when there is more investment, like, kids can do better, and it can change the trajectory of kids' lives. So
what I may do, Dr. Sojourner, is maybe have you leave this slide up, if that's okay, and be
yep.
moving to questions, and then you can be sort of weaving in, just in the interest of time, or making sure
yep.
we stay on track, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
And folks, there may be not many questions, but just in case that there are, I want to make sure we have some time before we do the bill, which I think is a nice connection to the presentation you've made, which was deliberate, I'll point out. questions from members at all, if folks have. Yes, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sojourner, going back to the point regarding return on investment and, you know, that 8% versus 6% roughly return on investment difference, I'm curious about how that's measured. Like, what are we looking at when we say there's an 8% return on investment and you're comparing that to a stock?
Yeah.
What's the apples-to-apples comparison there?
Dr. Sojourner, maybe your slide, Dr. Sojourner, I don't know if your slide about returns to stock market maybe, but Dr. Sojourner, please.
Yeah, I think he's asking a great question, which is, you know, like, what's the nuts and bolts behind that? I'll leave this one up too for my contact info if you want.
Yeah,
so again, think about this. So the 6% rate of return in the stock market is basically, let's take a dollar and invest it in the stock market, like a broad diversified, you know, stock portfolio. And then let's wait a year, let's wait 50 years, and like average over all the years since World War II, what's the average annual rate of return on that dollar? So I put it in at any given day between the end of World War II and now, and go forward a year, and, you know, how much did I earn through dividends, through stock appreciation, through buybacks, like basically everything. So that gives me the rate of return to the stock market. Adjust it for price inflation to get it in real terms, average over all the different possible days I could have invested. That tells you the average rate of return in the stock market. And it basically expresses, like, how well will the private sector do with a dollar of capital investment on average, right? In terms of the early childhood investment, what it is there was a, you know, they were studying particular programs, and what they were looking at was, okay, there's an upfront cost, just like you have to buy a stock for a dollar. You put a dollar into this program. Program serves kids. You're going to maybe have that program for 2 years, so you got to pay $1 and then another dollar, or $10,000 and then another $10,000, but like per dollar. And then let's look at all the costs and benefits that flow from that by comparing what would have happened with the money spent on that program versus what would have happened without the money spent on that program. So compare the treatment group to the control group and say, again, like, in the treatment group, the program costs this much. We have the treatment group tells us what happens if we spend that money. We have the control group, they tell us what happens if we don't spend the money. And we look at what happens. So there were, you know, more kids held back and had to repeat a K-12 grade. That's $15,000, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out. Discount that back, compute the net present value. So you're actually computing the internal rate of return. It's like the net present value, basically. It's related to net present value or cost, a benefit-cost ratio. It's a slightly different accounting concept. But So that's a benefit that you're getting, is averted grade retention. You know, averted juvenile justice involvement. There's some expense for that. Adult, you know, crime, there's cost to that. Benefits are, in the future, they're earning more. They're more likely to be working. They're paying, more likely to be earning higher wages. That's benefit. So you have a stream of benefits. You have a stream of costs up front. If the outcomes were negative, like if there were negative impacts, you know, that would be a cost. But you then basically compute the internal rate of return for, like, the equivalent. Like, if I, how much per dollar do I spend up front, and how much benefit does that buy me down the road, adjusting for inflation and time discounting?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like the return is measured in both public dollars that are saved for lack of having to repeat a grade, and also potentially private dollars that are earned or saved through averting future issues.
It's not just tax dollars, public dollars. It's a broader notion that tries to reflect total social impact in the private economy as well. The same thing with the stock, though. Like, the stock is pure, like, the return is a private return.
Okay. Representative Hudson, please, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that clarification, because it wasn't immediately obvious to me what the comparison was. As I reflect on my status quo, being a father of two boys, age 13 and 9, and I think about how quickly the time has gone by, this kind of common parental lament that there just doesn't seem to be enough time. And this chart, the one that shows the time breakdown, the standard business hours that a child spends with different folks, different categories of care, it kind of puts an exclamation point on that the older my kids get, on average, the less time I get to spend with them, not only in terms of how many years are left, but how much of each of those years I'm going to be spending in their presence. And there's an intangible but very real value there in time spent with family, time spent between parent and child.
Yeah,
I wonder to what degree that value enters into the calculation. Because it's very easy to get lost in the, you know, the bureaucratic and accounting math of it all, and lose track of that type of intangible. Did you perceive that, or was that incorporated or looked at all in this study?
Dr. Sojourner.
So I'll say, one of my favorite expressions is, like, as a parent, is like, the days are long, but the years are short, right? Like, it's hard work at the time, but it, like, goes by in a flash. I have two teenagers too, and like, I can see the value of that time with them, and it's very precious. I think if you talk to parents of, well, okay, so to be very specific, this study, no, it doesn't. These kinds of studies don't, they don't, they're about the things that I was talking about, not that. I'll say that I have another study that reanalyzes this data using an economic model where parents do value time with their children and do value leisure time and do value earning time, and they're trying to balance these things. And it does show that parents do value time with their kids on average. When they're young, this is in 0 to 3, and, you know, some people more and other people's less, and blah blah blah. Some people, and they value, like, their kids' development, and they can value it differently. Like, some people can care about it more, and others can care about it less. And they're trading these things off, and these policies where you invest in high quality care do make families better off in that model. It's like an economic model. You know, you can argue about the assumptions, and we're happy to talk about them ad nauseum. But the fact is, like, parents with young children get a lot of time with their kids. That In the first 5 years of life, kids spend an average of 19 hours a week out of their parents' care. 19 hours a week. There's 168 hours in a week. So parents, on average, spend 148 hours a week caring for a kid, and on average, 20 hours a week not caring for a kid, or, you know, both of them not caring for the kid. So that's, take what you will.
I think Representative Zalesnikar. Yeah, if
thank you.
Has it done. Yeah, Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And Doctor, can you, I just have a question, because I, the point that you made that we ask the most of parents when they have the least, I'm wondering if any of the data shows any change in enrollment for the early childhood, you know, these formative years before they get to the school system. For those who aren't qualifying for assistance with child care, because they have the income levels, which I understand that, but how does the fact that what the cost of eggs are right now and the cost of housing affecting those people's access? Because are we seeing any changes of enrollment? We know the gaps in learning have changed the needs of children coming out of a pandemic. I just listened in a presentation about the value of smiles, that this formation of relationships. So I'm wondering if you have any data on that, because that concerns me that we have, regardless of income, a gap of need for all children.
Dr. Sojourner.
You're asking about during, like recently.
Recently, yes.
Yeah. I think, so it's we don't have good measurement, really, of kids' experiences. There's a couple national surveys that have been done, like, that gave us this data. But they're like every 7 years, and we had one in 2019, but we haven't had one since. One thing that we do see is that the child care workforce is still well below its level pre-pandemic, so we're still about, I think, 8 or 9, 10% below where we were. So that tells me that families are not using as much care services as they were pre-pandemic, about 10% less probably, right? And yeah, it's a combination of factors. Like, I think care arrangements have become less stable and reliable with COVID and health risks. And so it's become sort of less, harder to manage. And also, yeah, like with wage increases, and it's become harder to attract people to the sector and keep them in the sector because, again, they're being outbid by Home Depot and stuff.
And actually, we're going to need to wrap up relatively soon, so I ask you, I'm going to go back to Representative Zalesnikar. So, Representative Zalesnikar, and I'll ask you just to keep your answers pretty short if you can.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem. Representative Zalesnikar.
Do you think it's possible that those that aren't qualifying, that are middle income, are not accessing the programs right now because they don't have enough money to spread to get their children into these programs?
Dr. Sojourner.
Yeah, I think, like, even for low-income families, we do not fund, there's not enough funds to cover everyone who's eligible, and that's a barrier for them accessing care. For middle-income families, there's less support, and I think that is certainly a barrier for them as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks, Representative Zalesnikar. Representative Hicks.
I thank you so much, and thank you, Representative, for bringing that up, because I actually have a family in my district who is experiencing exactly what you're talking about. So the mother is a PCA at Mayo Clinic, and the father is a painter, and they have an infant, and they've been unable to find a slot. They're over the threshold for support, and yet their income, they have not been able to find a slot. And so they are what you described, piecemealing child care together between family and friends, and sometimes people call into work or can't go to a shift, or and they're really struggling. And that's the exact situation you're describing. And so I think it's really important that we just kind of acknowledge that that support is absolutely needed. And that's why we're here today, to hear this wonderful opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thanks for all of your insightful information. So in your 2013 study, you indicated that not only did the kids have higher quality, but the parents also kind of increase in their quality and their well-being. So that makes me wonder if we were to invest more earlier over the span of a lifetime, could we also see those benefits in the health and the well-being of our senior citizens?
Dr. Sojourner.
Yeah, I think there is evidence that, again, like, this has lifelong impact. So, you know, we have to wait to see those benefits. Although, you know, I think another angle on it is that a lot of families are dealing with care responsibilities for young kids and elderly folks, and so that's a double sandwich generation kind of problem.
And I'll note, we heard from Dr. Subramanian on the first day about adverse childhood experiences and how they have these lifelong health effects, and they're certainly connected to this as well, having good early experiences as opposed to early adverse childhood experiences. So, good. I think we should probably wrap up. Dr. Sojourner, this has been really, really helpful and a great way to kick off our work. I can think of a bunch of topics I want to ask you about and bring up. We may be reaching out in the future, but thank you so much.
Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you so much. I'm going to head up front and hand the gavel to my vice chair. Madam Chair, if you're recognizing me.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto. Next, we have House File 150 on the agenda. Do I have a motion from the Chair to bring House File 150 to the committee?
You do, Madam Chair. I move that House File 150 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and not to freak anybody out. That doesn't mean it's going to Ways and Means right now. That's just the form of the motion for it to eventually get there. And I will describe the bill at this time, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
Sounds great. Thank
you. Okay, going to dive in. So, members, House File 150 is a bill that is aimed at a piece of what we were just discussing. I'm going to move this chair so I can see my colleagues.
Thank you.
The chair moves the chair. Members, House File 150 is aimed at addressing some very urgent needs in the area of early care and learning. So we are going to be passing a budget shortly to fund our state government and to provide support for families starting July 1. But in the meantime, we know that that the situation in our early care and learning sector is dire. I wish that we'd had sort of even more testimony on this, but Dr. Sojourner touched on a little bit in his slide about the crises in the market. We have child care providers who are squeezed. We are losing them. I should note, by the way, this is not unique to Minnesota. This is true all around the country. It's not specific to Minnesota's regulatory environment or otherwise. This is something happening all around because of the dynamics that Dr. Sojourner identified, which are true all around the country. So we had a crisis in this sector even before the pandemic. The crisis has gotten worse in the pandemic. We have a worker shortage. A reminder, we have the lowest unemployment in the country. And I think those of you who work with businesses and organizations are aware of how incredibly difficult it is to find workers. Childcare is the number one priority for a number of our statewide business associations and others, recognizing huge need. So we've got that squeeze. We have parents who need to work in order to afford to have a stable home for their child and afford food, etc. And so all this, what we want to do is to get early care and learning to families as quickly as we can, recognizing we have massive needs, and we do have the opportunity to help meet those needs in the short term, in the next few months before passing a budget. So at House File 150, I should maybe note that one aspect of House File 150 as originally drafted is that we were attempting to address the waiting list in the Child Care Assistance Program and investing there. As the bill was put together, after being put together, I've understood, and it's kind of amazing that this time could pass by and not having quite figured this out, but we have a very complicated child care system in Minnesota built over many years. In order to reduce that waiting list, because of the structure of the system, really would require some long-term investment to give counties the confidence to have families come off the waiting list. And so bottom line is that my plan is not to invest in that area at this time through House File 150. We will be hearing a proposal in this committee to increase rates in the Child Care Assistance Program in the very soon, and then certainly want to invest in that in our budget. But House File 150, you'll see Section 2 has an investment in the Basic Sliding Fee Program for CCAP, and I don't plan to move forward with that at this time, but again, not because of any lack of commitment to CCAP. And instead, when the bill is, in fact, voted on and heard, we'll be providing early care and learning through another means. And in particular, you'll notice a reference in Section 4 to early learning scholarships. This is a form of investment through the Department of Education. Ms. Mock on Tuesday described this somewhat to us. And the idea would be to get families child care and early learning right away through that mechanism. So that's in Section 4 of the bill. We want to get that going right away, even as we're doing longer-term work. And then the other component of the bill, which is in Sections 1 and 3, relates to the monthly stabilization grants. You have an item in your packet, which is a report on the child care stabilization grants. You'll see this on year one of that. This was passed in 21 to have monthly payments to every licensed provider in the state, recognizing that this is a public good which needs public investment. Those payments have been keeping the sector afloat. You're going to see some statistics in the report about how incredibly helpful these have been in just causing these providers to keep operating. I want to make sure we're clear. They're not taking any fancy vacations on this money. They are not closing because of this, and therefore being able to continue to provide a vital public service. So in March, those payments are scheduled to drop in half, which will cause major, major problems. So Sections 1 and 3 invest funding to make sure that the payments can stay up at the level that they were just through July 1. We'll assess and work on a budget then for the upcoming biennium. I think, Madam Chair, that probably summarizes pretty well. I know there's a number of testifiers. There may be questions from members. It may be that we just want to go to the testifiers unless there's questions and then have discussion, whatever you think.
I think not seeing any questions, I think we'll move to...
There
are questions. Go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Chair Pinto, you state that we'll be looking at the next biennium at some point. So are we to take away then that we're potentially looking at extending these stabilization grants beyond June 30th of 2023?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. Potentially. So I come at this, just stepping back for a second. Also in 21, we established something called the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force. This is a Republican Senate DFL House enacting this. And that task force had three goals that were established and that said, hey, this is something we need to do as a state. Make sure early care and learning is affordable for families, that it's high quality for kids, and that it pays livable wages to the people who do this work. This is the lowest paid job your kid can get coming out of college, even though it's about the most important thing that we can do. That takes a lot of investment. That's significant. The exact mechanism as to how we get there, I will say that I'm thinking through, and it depends a little bit on the amount of money that we are willing as a state and as a legislature and as a government to invest at this time. So I'm on record as saying public good needs public investment. The exact form of that, I will have to see exactly what our target is and how, but I will say I would not be at all surprised if that's something that you're going to see coming as a proposal from me to this committee, that we do continue those payments in some form. All I know is for now, let's keep the sector afloat until July 1, which is the purpose of HF 150.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Chair Pinto, so the intention of the stabilization grants, as the name suggests, was to try to compensate, try to keep them afloat, keep the doors open during the pandemic. Surely the effects of that were present during that time have waned to some degree. Is this a scenario where the stabilization grants, the purpose for which they were intended, is kind of incrementally shifting towards a more permanent need that needs to be addressed through another category?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Representative Hudson, I think that in a way, so again, our state experienced a crisis when the pandemic hit, right? The thing is, this was a sector that was in a crisis for years and years before then. And so it sort of, the pandemic shone a light on something that has been present. I mean, again, when I go to work at my prosecution job, I'm dealing with the fact that we didn't make these investments 20 years ago and 25 years ago. And that's just, we just know that. In fact, let me just pause on that for a second. You know, I know in some states they base their prison building on third grade reading scores. Third grade reading scores directly related to what's going on when a child is three. So there's this crisis that has been present for a long time. And so I will say, for me, when these grants went in the first place, we were trying to stabilize a sector that was not just about the pandemic. It was part of it. But this is a sector that was, like, destabilized and causing us all to be paying a price for a long time. So I guess I don't actually view it as a shift exactly. This is a sector that was just completely having problems beforehand. And so it really does need stabilization even beyond the pandemic. Thank you.
Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, I'm a little concerned. The federal stabilization grants were only intended for a short period of time. We all know that. During our committee meeting, I believe it was about 2 years ago, one of our members brought up an amendment to notify the daycare providers that this would be temporary money, and to basically plan ahead. And now we're talking about, it sounds like maybe extending these with our state dollars into the future. I don't disagree with that we need more money than some of the child care programs, but this was only to be a Band-Aid to get us through. And I'm just wondering why we want to keep calling them a stabilization grant, as Representative Hudson said, because we knew where they were going to end. I mean, it was federal funds are done. So just want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Daniels. I actually disagree that the expectation, even at the time, I mean, I was that they would necessarily be temporary. We certainly funded them through the 2 years. I'll point out that as these stabilization grants were approved by the House, they did include the full payment through July 1. So what this is really doing is getting us back to what the House has already voted for in 21. For me, again, the grants are as much a recognition that the people doing this work are doing public work, and that has a huge payoff for the rest of us. And yeah, we did vote down that proposal to send a notice to providers saying, basically, you know, we're going to for a short time recognize how important it is, the work that you do, and then we're going to stop that. And we're going to throw everybody back into the same mess that we were in before, where we're not recognizing the payoff, to my mind. So that was not necessarily what I had in mind, and I don't think that that's what we passed. I mean, we did, in fact, pass something that kept the payments steady all the way through, and without that notice, because we want to make sure that we have continued public investment. And I should note, too, in part this is recognizing there's a need for the lowest income families. Dr. Sojourner focused on that. But there also is a need more generally that there is a big payoff, and that by not doing this, we are squeezed in all kinds of ways.
Lee Daniels.
I'm just a little confused. This was a one-time thing, and now it's not going to be a one-time thing. That's just my comment. I just, you know, don't think that's fair to call it stabilization grants when that was from the federal government coming from the federal government. Now we're going to switch it over to Minnesota taxpayers. So just want to make that clear that I believe that should have been a one-time thing. If you want to add more money to child care in a different way, I think that would be appropriate. But that's just my thoughts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. You know, Representative Daniels, maybe what I suggest is maybe we sort of take this step by step. This is not a proposal to extend this beyond July 1. We did pass in the House essentially this to keep the payments just steady till July 1. We can, and I know will, have vigorous debate in the committee about things that we do after July 1. What this is about is just saying, hey, let's keep the sector stable. And I think when we hear from testifiers, we'll hear how necessary this is.
But for now, so I'd sort of say maybe we can, we're going to continue having this debate, but the post-July 1, I might suggest that we sort of address when that's before us. And for now, this is just a question of, do we keep the payments at the same rate up until July 1, which folks may disagree with, but at least I think it's a little bit different point than the long term, if that makes sense.
Lee Daniels.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Coulter, and also we have 15 minutes. We still have testifiers to get in. Thank you.
Thank you. I actually, Chair Pinto just made the exact point that I was going to make. I think this is certainly a valuable conversation, but I think it's one that we should have through the budget process rather than the bill that's before us today, which pretty clearly says payments run through June of 2023, and what happens after that, I think we can talk about at a later date.
Thank you. First testifier, Madam Chair.
No more questions. We'll call testifiers. Keeping in mind of time, our testifiers will have 3 minutes. We'll be keeping time and let you know. We will start with Deborah Messenger. Testifiers, as you come down, if you can let us know your name, preferred pronouns, and the organizations you are with, that's helpful for the record.
My name is Deborah Messenger, and I am with Kids Count on Us. And I'd like to say good morning to the Chair Pinto and members of the committee. I have been in child care as a child care teacher and a building owner of All Ages and Faces Academy in St. Paul, Minnesota. My child care experience has been over 23 years, and I'm also a leader in Kids Count on Us. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Tears. That's how one of the staff reacted when first told they would be receiving a bonus from the first child care stabilization grants. They cried because they were overwhelmed at how impactful a few hundred dollars was for them. I'm not exaggerating or embellishing this story. This is exactly what happened. Can you imagine working in a profession that you love, knowing that you're making a huge difference in the lives of children and families, but being paid no more than a dog walker or a pet sitter for your talent, time, and energy? We as a society have undervalued and underpaid our child care professionals for far too long. This child care stabilization grant has given us a tiny glimpse of what a child care system looks like. Teachers that are being compensated what they deserve. Families getting accessible and affordable child care that they need. And children getting the high quality care that we know makes a huge difference between the ages of 0 and 5. These three core values can only be honored if we fund our child care system. One of many crises child care faces at the moment, staffing is by far the most pressing. Many teachers cannot afford to continue to work in child care. We cannot provide living wages to our child care teachers without public funds. Cost of care for families is already too expensive, with the stabilization grant set to decrease in March and end altogether at the end of July. Many centers like mine will be at risk to close our doors because we lose the teachers we've barely been able to hold on to with these grants. I am pleased to see that HF 150 returns the grants to their 2021 levels in June, through June. This is absolutely necessary if we want to even have a child care system in the coming months. Yes, the situation is that dire and that urgent. Please take the words of myself and other child care providers I speak for during this very job very serious when I tell you that without these grants, we will not be able to hire and retain teachers and staff. And without them, we will not have a child care system at all. I urge you to vote in favor of this emergency bill to allow us to stay open as we work together over legislative sessions to build a sustainable child care system with values, family values, children, providers, and teachers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Messenger. That was great. Next up, we have Erica Moss. After that, we'll have Claire Sanford. please remember to introduce yourself, pronouns, and organization. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Erica Moss, preferred pronouns she, her, and I lead advocacy in support of early learning scholarships for Think Small. As part of my role, I also staff a group of Minnesota CEOs called Minnesota Business for Early Learning, which continues a nearly 20-year push by the business community to expand access to high-quality early care and education. We support House File 150, which would recognize the emergency facing so many Minnesota families with young children and give at least some of them immediate relief in the form of early learning scholarships. This relief will mean fewer families having to, quote, take whatever care they can get, that's what families say, and more parents able to go to work. Think Small administers early learning scholarships for Hennepin and Ramsey counties, where there's a wait list of nearly 900 children. To give you a sense of the children that make up that number, 85% of current scholarship recipients, the scholarships that Think Small has awarded are in a priority category, which means that they are or recently have experienced homelessness, foster care, or the child protection system, or have a teen parent. Over 80% self-identify as non-white, and all are living in low-income communities. In low-income families. While 900 seems like a large number, it does not even come close to reflecting the need, as families are not actively recruited when there is already a waiting list. We estimate the actual need to be closer to 31,000 un- or underserved children, the vast majority of whom are infants and toddlers. They would be eligible for scholarships, but are not able to get a scholarship because there's a lack of funding. So while every child moved from a waiting list into a program is a victory, we will be back here before you in the coming weeks and months to ensure that all of those 31,000 children receive help in the biennial budget. The early care and education sector, as we just heard, is experiencing a 5-alarm fire, and it's this committee's job to bring the resources necessary to extinguish it. This one-time emergency funding represents a glass of water. Minnesota kids, providers, and families are counting on you to bring the full brigade. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Claire Sanford. Welcome to the committee. Please let us know your name, pronouns, organizations, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam. Ooh. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford. I am on the board of the Minnesota Child Care Association, and I am here, obviously, to talk about child care. And I'm so excited. I haven't done this in person in 3 years, so thanks for letting me kick the cobwebs out today. So the Minnesota Child Care Association is a statewide association of child care centers, and we stand for quality for kids, choice for families, and compensation for the professionals who serve them. And I am here in support of HF 150 and love that it is an emergency bill that addresses both supply and demand. And just a little bit about me, I started my career as an elementary school teacher in a low-income public school. And within 3 years, I was on my way to policy school because I was shattered and ashamed at the challenges I saw my students facing. And to Dr. Sojourner's earlier points, those challenges didn't start when they showed up in my third grade classroom. And I wondered what had happened or not earlier that we needed to think about. Many had not had access to high-quality early childhood development. And the piece of this bill around scholarships would give quickly many, many more families access to just that. We know the demand for childcare is there, but choice is not, because families don't have the resources to be able to make those choices. I can give you a soliloquy on why childcare is so expensive another time. Families need the resources to access what meets their needs. If we want folks in the workforce, these investments now through scholarships would do just that. The supply piece through the stabilization grants and not letting that amount of stabilization grant fall between now and June, also huge. As you've heard, we had a child care crisis pre-pandemic. Our own child care workforce is still about 8% below the already inadequate levels we had before the pandemic. We are not even back to the bad place we were in before. We need more spots across the state, but frankly, we can't even fill all the spots we currently have because we do not have our own teachers. Compensation is a huge piece of that, and 70% of these stabilization grants have been going for the last year and a half to increased compensation. Many providers are giving 100% to increased compensation because this is the need. We talk to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We pay more for child care, or we pay more for parking lot attendants to care for our cars during the day than we pay the professionals who care for and educate our young children. What message does that send? We cannot go backwards on compensation. And when I pick my car up at the end of the day, it hasn't been washed, it hasn't been fed, the fluids aren't topped up, and it might have some dings in it. And no one made it excited to learn or made it feel loved. And we're paying the parking lot attendants more than the professionals for our young children. So please do support this part of the bill as well. It is a way to help keep some increased compensation for our early educators without passing that cost burden on to parents, because we know they can't handle it. I can't wait to meet you all. You may have feel differently after listening to me this morning, and I'm only one Coke Zero into my day. But thank you. I look forward to the long conversation we're going to have this session about what's truly needed. And please support this short-term patch so we can get that moving while we do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Next up, we have Amy Wallstein.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Chair Pinto, and members. My name is Amy Wallstein, she, her, and I'm the Senior Policy Director for Education and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Business Partnership. We're a trade organization that represents the CEOs and senior leaders of Minnesota's largest companies, and our members care deeply about early care and early learning. We're involved in initiatives including the Early Care and Education Crisis Working Group, the Itasca Project, First 1,000 Days, Little Moments Count, Minnesota Business for Early Learning, and much more. Our members strongly support the recommendations in House File 150 to invest additional funds in the Early Learning Scholarship Program, and we want to thank Chair Pinto for including this provision in the bill. Investing in early learning scholarships for the low-income children under age 5 who can't access quality early child care and education programs is critical. These are the children whose families can least afford child care, and the children who are most likely to fall into opportunity and achievement gaps that pose a threat to their future. Scholarships have proven to be one of our best tools for helping children access those quality programs, and we strongly support the provisions in Section 4 to boost this program in the short term. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, I did miss one testifier, Cindy Cunningham.
She may not be here. Written testimony, I gather, Madam Chair.
Yep, sounds good. So there is numerous written testimony in all of your packets, if you would like to read that as well. Chair Pinto, do you want to say anything to follow up?
No, Madam Chair, if there may be, and if there's other questions or discussion on the substance of the bill, I'm happy to talk further about kind of where things are going from here, but if there are questions or discussion at all on it, I'm certainly open to that. The members have. There might not be.
Doesn't look. Not seeing any questions.
Okay, Madam Chair. In that case, I guess I'll. It is my hope in chairing the committee that we will have. Pretty limited discussion on the substance of the bill in the future, sort of this being the opportunity for that. Of course, there will be an amendment coming forward, as I say, when we next hear the bill. I would expect to remove Section 2, as I referenced, and I think you can expect a few other changes, and of course we'll have discussion about that when the bill is up, but it is my hope that sort of this is the substance of it. I will say that several folks who had wanted to testify in this bill were unable to do so because they're busy caring for kids, and they couldn't, they had to do that work. Members, this is a piece to my mind of things that we should be moving on very quickly this session, in order to get early care and learning to families. There may be several other pieces that will be advancing relating to that as well, that to my mind are fixing pieces of the system that are broken. And essentially what this is applying a tourniquet to a gaping wound, to a gushing wound. There's a lot that we need to do in addition, but let's at least get families the child care that they need and the stabilization for the sector. And so with that, Madam Chair, I have nothing further. I think you'll be laying the bill over and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair Pinto. I will add, I do agree this is really needed. To me, you know, it's a big retention piece. You know, we're losing really high quality people who are in the business of love. They're in the business of love, to love on the children that we love the most. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward. I appreciate the conversation. And I think we all agree that this is a piece of investment that is important to Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you.
We're reaching the end of committee today. We won't take a vote on this. We will be laying it over. If there's any more questions? No?
Okay.
Committee's adjourned.
Thank you.